to another episode of Up My Nursing Game, the podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. This podcast is sponsored by none other than Stoggles, maker of the most fashionable PPE out there. Use the promo code UMNG10 to save 10% on your next Stoggles order. All right, guys, so this episode will be a little bit different because it is a live recording of a talk I gave at the inaugural Nurses PodCon in Nashville, Tennessee last November. I've recorded the live episode with Jamie Frigeau from the Neurodivergent Nurse podcast about rapid responses. Jamie is a rapid response nurse, so I picked her brain about some rapid response scenarios. As always, don't forget to claim your free unit of continuing education for this episode by going to vcu.cloud-cme.com. All of this is in the show notes. All right, listen in.
All right, Jessica, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I also want to recognize Tina for putting on this inaugural event. I'm just so impressed with her and her podcast and her taking the initiative to do all of this while working full time in the ICU. I'm just so thankful for you, and I'm happy to be here today. Also happy to have Jamie at my side here. Jamie, go ahead, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about who you are and just a little bit about your podcast. I know you have your own session later today.
Yeah, so my name is Jamie Frigeau. I do host a podcast, The Neurodivergent Nurse. I've been a nurse for, I don't know, a little over 10 years, primarily in the neuro ICU. I did travel nursing for about 4 years, worked all over the country at some amazing places. I learned so many things. And now I currently work as a rapid response nurse, probably for the last 2 years or so, which has been a blast. It's really the best job I've ever had.
Jamie's podcast is about having ADHD while being a nurse. And I think the little I know about rapid response nurses is that seems to be like a perfect fit.
Oh yeah, you get those dopamine hits just all the time. When the phone rings, you don't know what they're going to be calling for. Is it someone who doesn't have a pulse, which you hope that's not the case? Or is it someone who they have maybe an emergency and they can't get in touch with a physician? Or is it something they need to troubleshoot, which is kind of what we're going to talk about today, how to prepare ourselves for those situations when typically you call us, but things that you can do and know before you call so you can get those things going before we show up.
And then you're on to the next after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the great aspects of being a rapid response nurse, I'm sure. So I asked Jamie to come on today because I wanted to talk about some rapid response situations that a nurse can handle. So I wanted to talk about nurse-led rapid responses, so things that nurses can do on our own within our scope of practice. I had so much fun coming up with topics, like what could we talk, like what can't we talk about with like nurse-led rapid responses. And I ended up coming up with topics that are, I will say, are equipment malfunctions. So at the beginning, we're going to talk about tracheostomy emergencies, which are obviously very frightening as a nurse because we're talking about airway here. And, you know, often when patients have tracheostomies, they're very sick to begin with. And so when one starts to malfunction, it can be utterly terrifying and a very good reason to get on the phone with your rapid response nurse.
Definitely. Yeah. And now in the last couple of years with COVID, I feel like we have a lot of trachs that end up on the floor.
Absolutely.
So we see them a lot more. I know in neuro ICU that we had tons of trach patients. And so when we would send them to the floor, those were things that the nurses had to know. But typically they would go to a neuro step down or just a neuro floor in general. But now with people who, unfortunately, with this pandemic, who they have COVID and they're not able to get off of the ventilator and they have to be trached. So now they're not just going to a neuro floor, they're going to any med surg floor, any intermediate floor. So this is, it's really something that's important for all nurses to know because they're getting these patients no matter what their area or their scope or their specialty is.
Absolutely. And I know when I took the NCLEX 7 years ago, I could list at the time, you know, what equipment I should have in the room if I have a trach patient. But over the years, that list has been covered with a layer of dust. So I thought before we kind of jump into some emergencies, we could talk about, like, well, how do you prevent emergencies from happening in the first place? And talk about, like, what should a nurse always have in the room when they have a trach patient?
Definitely. You want to prevent it before it happens. The one thing that always stuck out in my head, even charting, so you have a trach patient, the one thing you always had to chart, no matter what facility I worked at, was obturator at bedside. You, no matter where you are. But in my own personal practice, so like I said, the obturator is one thing you want to make sure that you have. And it's this little, it has a rounded point on it, so if the trach were to come out, that it's something that you can put the Shiley back in with. But you want to make sure that that's in a biohazard bag, somewhere that is tape, where you can see it, you can instantly grab it. So number one, you have to have an obturator at bedside at all times whenever you have a patient who's trached.
I actually had to look up obturator before we had this talk today. As someone who, you know, I'm not regularly taking care of trach patients, I had to look it up. If you think about starting an IV, when you have your needle to help, you know, you start the IV, remove it, and then you have the cannula that stays, it's the same concept where the obturator would be the needle and then the trach would be the cannula, or you can, you know, it is a cannula. So you can think of it as kind of helping thread the trach into the patient. And the reason why we use them, we don't just kind of stick the trach inside the patient, is because it's a lot of soft tissue in there, and you would do a whole lot of damage to that soft tissue if you just stuck like a very rigid cannula inside. So this is to prevent trauma and possible fistulas in the future. So I learned what an obturator was. I guess I always knew, or I saw it, but I didn't know the name of it. So
my very first job as a nurse, guys, if you are listening and you are currently a nurse, listen to this. So this was in 2011, and there was a big hiring freeze whenever I graduated. But the only job that I could get initially was working for a pulmonologist. So I worked with him, I would go in the ICU with him, and then I would work in his like outpatient clinic, making $13 an hour as an RN. But we did this thing where he did an education where people could get CEUs as well. And that was one of the things that we did, was trach care. And I still remember he had a mannequin that was set up in the room, and the trach was out. And he had all of these nurses come by to say what they were going to do first. And none of them remembered to ask for the obturator. So that's the one thing that always stuck in my head.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully you have RT who can help you, but you know, sometimes it's, you know, RT is not available. So we need to be able mm-hmm. to be familiar with the obturator and use it. So obviously we need the obturator. What else should we have at bedside?
Hopefully if your patient is trached, that you have good suction set up. So you want to have your suction canister, and you want to have a Yonker as well as the smaller suction that is sterile that you would go through, because did it pop out because they were coughing too hard? Is that what happened? You're going to have to end up clearing that airway as well. So that's another thing you want to make sure that you have that is working at bedside as well.
You're talking about like a 14 French.
Yes.
Sterile.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. That and then the regular Yonker as well.
What about the trach? My understanding is that like you should have the same size of trach and a smaller one.
Absolutely.
In addition mm-hmm. to that.
Yeah. So especially if it's a newer trach, as you were talking earlier, that the tissue is soft, and if it pops out, it doesn't stay the same size necessarily, right? So the skin will try to close in a little bit. So you may not be able to get that same size Shiley back in, but if you have one size smaller, that is going to be a lot easier to help keep that place open so that we can protect that airway.
So what do we have here? We have your suction catheter, two of them, is the Yankauer and the flexible catheter. I think lubricant would be a good idea too.
Definitely.
Get some of that KY jelly in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, an Ambu bag. Well, that should be in every patient room, but you know, especially if you have a trach patient. And yeah, trach ties. To hold that down.
Yeah, because as I was saying earlier, if they were coughing and it came loose, or did it come out because they broke the ties, or we can't find them, having them because things get lost in a bed, right? So did the piece that was holding the trach on well, did that come off altogether? So if you have something that is easily accessible and you know exactly where it is, you're not going to have to dig through the covers. You're not going to have to look under the pillows to jump in that emergency. So having it at hand, worst case scenario, trach ties, definitely one of those things that you want to have there that you can grab quickly.
Can we talk about the difference if we're talking about a fresh trach versus a chronic trach? So I don't think there's much consensus on what fresh means, but we'll say within the first week or two of it being established, that this is kind of a different scenario. Can you just talk a little bit about like how you would handle the situation of dislodgement or a trach just coming out with a fresh trach versus an established trach?
Yeah, if we're talking about an established trach, then chances are this patient has had it for quite some time. And they may just have a stoma there. They may not have a Schiele that's in place. But that tissue has formed. It has healed if it has been established over some time. But if you say, let's say that you fell down and you cut your arm, right? You have this big gash in your arm. Well, it's going to take time for that to heal, and it's going to... your body's going to be doing all of these things so that it can, you know, kind of scar over. It's going to do all of those things. So if you have a fresh trach and it pops out, the body is still in that healing process. So it's going to constrict. Your body's going to jump to try to help out because it sees that as an injury. If you have anything foreign in your body, then it thinks that there is something that is trying to attack it. There's an injury there. And whereas if you have that established trach, someone who has had that for years, months, weeks, then it's not going to be as big of an emergency because the body has already started healing over and is not going to jump to that wanting to close everything up to get back to what it thinks is normal for it.
I think for me the difference would be that a nurse and an RT could handle the situation independently if it's an established trach and we're just recannulating the patient. If it's a new trach, you're getting on the phone with a doctor.
Right.
And making sure that you're in the right place. Actually, a nurse last night was telling me about a sentinel event at her hospital regarding a trach in which the trach was dislodged and then replaced in the subcutaneous space. And I've seen a picture of this before, and you start bagging that patient, you start delivering oxygen on them, and you can imagine with the you know, cannula in the subcutaneous space, they're just blowing up. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, the oxygen's going into the tissue and not going into the lungs, and the patient died. I think it's a great story to tell from a nurse's perspective. You know, don't be like that nurse who did that or that doctor who did that. And just make sure when you're, you know, replacing the cannula in a fresh trach that you're in the right space.
And can I also add that if you were in that emergent situation and you replace that Schiele, that trach, remember to take the obturator back out. Yeah. Because if you leave it in, I mean, we all panic in emergencies, right? We lose our minds in a sense because it's terrifying because you want this person to survive. So the one thing for us to remember, if you're like, yes, I remember this podcast and they said that we have to use this and this is how we put it in, but you have to pull it out because it will occlude that airway while you're trying to manage everything else that's going on with the patient.
I didn't even think about that. I'm so glad you brought that up. And I think this would also be a great plug-in for Entitle CO2 to also verify that you're in the right place and that the patient is adequately oxygenating. So not just pulse ox, have that on there, of course, but Entitle would be a great piece of data to have as well.
Another thing that is good, if we're just talking about things to have at bedside, worst case scenario, because you know, just having a little bit of protection goes a long, long way because emergencies do happen. I mean, we don't ever want it to happen, but realistically, it's a thing. You also want to have a 10 cc syringe or 10 milliliter syringe because a lot of the, at times they have, some of them have the little balloons on it. And so if it's cuffed, you're going to have to put air in there to help keep it in place. So if you do have a trach that is cuffed, if it does have that little balloon part to it, you also want to have that syringe at bedside to help you in that situation.
Just to finish up this topic, that brings up a good point about how do we oxygenate these people when they're having this trach emergency? Because you know, we need to make sure they're getting adequate oxygen while we're fumbling around getting all the equipment to recannulate them. What is your strategy for oxygenating these people who are without a trach?
As you said earlier, hopefully most places you have a bag valve mask at bedside. If you don't, they are always on your code cart. So that's one thing that if it's not at bedside as it should be, just remember your code cart has most things that you could ever want in an emergency. But you would want to use that bag valve mask over the stoma because obviously you're not going to want to bag necessarily over their mouth and nose because that's the whole purpose of the trach because they can't oxygenate through that airway as well.
If they're cuffed, so I guess there are different types of trach emergencies. Mm-hmm. There could be still a cuff in there, and if the cuff is inflated, then bagging through the mouth is not going to be helpful
exactly.
At all. Yeah. So I think it's an important point to bring up that when we think of bagging patients, we're doing it over the mouth, but when you're bagging trach patients, it's often going to be at the neck. Mm-hmm. And I think having a pediatric mask would be great just to fit the space better than an adult mask. I was also reading that an LMA is helpful too, just to get a nice seal.
One emergency that I was in one time with a patient who was, he had a trach and he went into respiratory distress, but he plugged off. That was what happened. But a lot of times, if you have ever been in an emergency when a patient had to be intubated and you know they attach that bag to the tube that is coming out of their mouth in that emergency, and they're giving them oxygen that way, a lot of times the respiratory therapist can also do it in a similar fashion. So they attach that tube and they attach that bag valve, and so they can oxygenate them as well. But that's a respiratory thing. They typically have that type of gear that they can grab and hook up to it. But in the meantime.
Yeah, I think, you know, RT will often be running the show here, but for us as a nurse to come prepared and know, you know, what equipment we need to be bringing to RT is really helpful as well. And make sure it's in the room in the first place.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so that is trach emergencies. Let's talk about another scary emergency that you come across as a rapid response nurse are chest tube emergencies. So again, we're talking about maybe not airway so much as breathing here, another big scary emergency that we can have with our patients. I just started working at a large academic hospital and I'm seeing chest tubes left and right. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited to talk about this today because I see them with so much more frequency. And, you know, obviously one chest tube emergency that I want to be prepared for with my patients is what if the damn thing comes out and my patient has a hole in their chest? And that's something that I'm like a fear I always have in the back of my mind when I have patients with chest tubes. And so like our trach emergencies, let's talk about what should we have there at bedside?
Chest tube. So this wasn't something that I saw all the time until I went into rapid response because, like I said, neuro ICU is my specialty. So, I mean, we dealt with brain injuries, but normally the lungs, we didn't have pneumos. We didn't have the situations that patients typically needed to have a chest tube. So it was a little bit, I remembered it from nursing school, but it was a little bit of a learning curve for me as well whenever I got into that role. But they definitely happen. And this is another situation, as you said, that you want to be prepared for the worst case scenario. So things that you want to have at bedside for chest tubes, you want to have what's called Kelly clamp. And at our facility, we like to have two Kelly clamps at bedside. And those are the things that they look like scissors. And sometimes the chest tubes actually come with like a plastic version of it. Mm-hmm. But if for some reason you lose that, they do have the metal versions available as well. But they look almost like needle nose pliers too.
Yep. If anyone's that's a good way of putting it. Yes.
So you want to have that there. You also want to have Vaseline gauze. So if it comes out completely, if the patient decides they get up but it's on the floor and they yank it out, you want to have that you can put over that gaping hole immediately and for it to be sterile as well. That's another thing really important. You want to try not to touch the gauze. You want to try not to touch the side that has that you're going to put to the patient as well. And you want to have tape that you can make a great seal. So there's a silk looking tape or this just wider. So that's going to give you a great seal around that gauze whenever you put it over the hole of the where the chest tube was.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to seal that area off. I'm always reminding my patients with chest tubes, like, Don't just get up from bed. Let me know first, because I can so easily see them, you know, in their state of confusion or whatever, just getting up from bed and forgetting that they're attached to their chest tubes here. So yeah, I've learned very quickly in my new job what to have at bedside here, and luckily I have not had this emergency yet. But one thing that some of the more veteran nurses on these pulmonary surgery floors have taught me is to tell the patient to bear down when the chest tube is removed. And that is to eliminate or start to, so the air that's in the pleural space that's not in the lungs can exit the body. And even tell them to do a few times. Like get that, you know, tell them to bear down, put on the Vaseline gauze, all right, let's do that again. Bear down and then, you know, let some more of the air escape and then put the Vaseline gauze on and then tape that bad boy up.
And of course, notify your provider.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's the answer to everything, right?
Yes, right. And when and that's a good point. When we're talking about nurse-led rapid responses, you know, these are things that we can do on our own, but obviously, like, you got to let the doctor know, and you have someone else calling the doctor. Mm-hmm. You're
right.
Staying with the patient.
Check vitals, check their O2, check all of those things, because we want to make sure that they're stable and that we don't need additional intervention on top of it.
So one other chest tube, I won't call it emergency, but situation that you could easily find yourself in is, what if the tube becomes disconnected from its box, right? So from the, what is the name of that box? I hear so many different names for the collection chamber.
Perfect.
Yeah. So if, let's say, a patient has a chest tube connected to a collection chamber and then the tube going to the collection chamber comes off. So you just got a patient with a tube coming out of their chest to nowhere.
Sure. I mean, chest tubes are easy to trip over as well. And those collection chambers, you have to change out, right? Because they do fill up. And maybe whomever the nurse was, they didn't put it together well. You know, they didn't make sure that it was fully connected. And so if the next nurse trips over it, then it's very easy for it to become disconnected from that chamber, like you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I was reading about this, they said, well, basically you need to get that tube into water.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you cannot let air go into that system. I could totally picture a nurse like grabbing like a canister for water, like a, you know, pitcher sleeve, just putting water in it and then put that tube right in there. And that's something you could totally do. And if you can't get that collection, a new collection chamber.
Sure, which is a good point too, that sterile water is a good thing to keep at bedside if you have a chest tube.
That would be a good idea. Mm-hmm.
You know, you just have those, they're not jars, but you have those containers that you have the sterile water in. That's always something too that I recommend having at bedside for someone who has a chest tube.
Yeah.
In that situation specifically.
So that's a great stopgap measure that you can do while your nursing colleague is going off and getting that new collection chamber. So, going on with our theme of equipment coming out or falling out, let's talk about G-tubes. This is something I'm sure you also see a lot in neuro ICU, you know, all of your trach PEG patients. I see a lot of G-tube patients for one reason or another. Actually, I saw this a lot in emergency with patients presenting from a SNF, for example, and they pulled out their G-tube. And it's actually happened to a patient of mine, unfortunately. She was confused. We didn't have the binder on her, and she pulled out her G-tube. What do you do? Their G-tube has come out, they have a hole going right into their stomach. What's important to keep in mind?
This was something, as you and I were talking about it, that stuck with me from nursing school. I always remembered that story that was told in nursing school, what you would do in this situation. And funny enough, several weeks ago, one of my colleagues that's on the rapid response team was telling me that he got a call because the situation actually happened, and it was a travel nurse that was there, and the travel nurse called and said, hey, so this G-tube, this PEG tube, I don't know, I wasn't there, so I don't know which one it was, but said, hey, it came out. From what I know, we need to put a Foley in.
Yeah.
Typically, your indwelling urinary catheter is a great thing for you to put in the place of that PEG tube, that G-tube, because it'll help keep that, as we were talking with Trix earlier, how the body starts instantly trying to constrict to heal itself, but it helps keep that part of the body open so that it can be replaced.
Absolutely. And often what's cool is that if you know the French, the size, the diameter size of the G-tube that came out, then you know to get that size of a Foley catheter. Or like our trach, like we were talking about, one size smaller if you're unable to get the full size in. And similarly with a trach, have the lubricant as well too. And there are a lot of parallels to G-tubes coming out with trachs, because you also need to make that consideration for, is this a fresh G-tube or is it established? And with the same concerns that you could create a false lumen with a fresh G-tube much more easily than you could with one that is established. And I have once seen a patient who developed peritonitis from a G-tube, and it's not something you forget very easily. Just make sure when you're putting in the Foley catheter that you're not putting anything through that Foley catheter, that you're just simply putting the catheter in to keep that stoma open, but no administering medications until the doctor's been made aware and appropriate scans have been made. And the last thing you want to do is just leave it there, right? Don't hesitate to get that Foley right away, because you don't want to be in the position of the stoma closing up and then the patient having to re-go surgery to establish a G-tube.
Just as I was saying with this travel nurse that called the rapid response team to say, what else do I need to do? It is always great, whether you are a permanent staff member, whether you are a traveler, every hospital has policies. So these, if you know that these are the type of patients that you will be taking care of, if you think that you will potentially have a patient who's going to have a trach, if you think that you're going to have a patient who is going to have a chest tube or a G-tube, look at your policy. What does the hospital say that you need to do? Do they allow you to put in the Foley? I've never worked at one that you could not put one in, but it's a good thing to just have in the back of your mind so that you are protected as a nurse working at that place as well in that situation. And realistically, you're trying to keep someone alive, especially with what we were talking about earlier. So priorities, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up that legal aspect of it, and that's always a concern, but it's something that you don't necessarily have time to deal with.
Exactly.
And if so, you would be that A-plus nurse if you went in and read the policies. You're that A-plus nurse, aren't you? You go to a new hospital and you're reading the policies.
Yeah, I like to keep my job.
Yeah. Yeah, I like having an RN license too. So before we go, I thought we could just touch on a different kind of emergency. You could, I guess, also call it equipment malfunction, but bedside cardioversion. This is something that, you know, nurses can do, and we don't necessarily need a physician to physically be present.
If you're ACLS certified.
Yes. Thank you for bringing up all these legalities in here. Yeah, I'm going rogue over here. Just saying, let's do all the things ourselves. You know, as someone who used to float to emergency, I often saw patients come in with SVT and rapid AFib. And there's a lot that can be done to cardiovert these patients. And I thought it'd be fun to talk about, like, what are some of the steps that we can take before we kind of progress into, like, shocking the patient or giving them, like, medical cardioverting medications?
It's funny. Whenever you mention this to me, one thing that everyone on my team knows is I hate cardioversion so much. It reminds me of like Jack in the Box, you know, like they just pop up. I can't stand it.
Yeah.
So I try very hard, like you're saying, if I know that a patient is potentially going to have to be cardioverted, I'm like, okay, let's do all the things first to make sure that I don't have to do this to you because I hate it so much. But yeah, there are definitely things that you can try to get them to do that could break them out of their SVT, for example. One thing that you can do is try to get them to bear down like they're having a bowel movement. Sometimes that can bring the rate down. Sometimes that vagal response can help put the heart where it needs to be, so they don't have to be shocked.
Right. It lowers the heart rate, essentially. Anything that stimulates the vagus nerve is going to lower the heart rate.
Right. And if just bearing down doesn't really work, a lot of times, some people will say, hey, here's a straw, blow through the straw. Something that I found that works even better is if you take a syringe and you pop off the plunger part, or you don't have to, but you try to get them to blow through the small part of the syringe because there's a lot of pressure there and they have to use a lot of force to try to blow it out.
I like that one. It's nice and clean. It's easy to provide instructions.
And we know where to get syringes if we're working in a hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's accessible.
Have you ever done the ice to face technique?
No, but I've heard about it, but I haven't.
Yeah. It just seems kind of messy and uncomfortable and not as nice and clean as that blowing through a syringe. Yeah. So if those vagal maneuvers don't work, your patient's still in SVT, their heart's going 180, 200 here, what do we do next?
Okay, so it also depends, are they symptomatic or are they asymptomatic? So if they're symptomatic, then it's probably something that we need to do very quickly. We don't have time to get on the phone to cardiology to make all the phone calls. But if they have no symptoms, if their blood pressure is hanging out and they're doing good, then we do have time to get in touch with our provider to get them at bedside to be able to administer Versed prior to doing things like that so that they don't have memories of such a traumatic event. But in the situation that we end up cardioverting an individual, a patient, the thing that I remember, whether you're using a Zoll, whether you're using a life pack, no matter what type of device that you're using, once you put the pads on, please make sure you hit the sync button on your device because you want to make sure that that device is being synced with every beat because you don't want to shock them on the wrong part. Then they have all of this pain and trauma and they jump out of the bed and it's not going to be effective.
No. And one intervention I've seen before is adenosine, which is like my favorite because I'm always saying like you can solve most of your technology problems by restarting, mm-hmm. turning something off and on. And that's essentially what adenosine is doing. And I actually, a friend of mine was recently in SVT and she got adenosine. And it was so fun to talk to her because I don't really get to ask my patients afterwards, like, what was it like when we restarted your heart? And the way she described it was she felt like she couldn't breathe for an hour, but it was actually just 5 seconds. But in that 5 seconds, your heart stops. Mm-hmm. And you're, in a sense, like, dead in a way. And I just loved her. I could totally picture her. She's like this very outgoing woman, and just like imagining her there, just feeling like, I can't breathe. It's lasting forever, but it was just 5 seconds.
And I mean, it's, again, coming from like a brain background, it terrifies me with these things because you just watch a patient go flatline. Which is also a good point. You want to educate them on what to expect prior Absolutely. To doing either one, because most of the time in these situations, they are cognizant. And so you want to say, hey, we're going to give you this medication. It's going to cause your heart to pause for about 5 seconds or so. You may feel like you get kicked in the chest, but don't worry. It's okay. We're here. And also, while we're talking about this too, having oxygen at bedside, even if they haven't required it the entire time, I love to put just a little bit of O2 because with cardioverting someone, you may end up having to give them Versed, like I said, that would cause their respirations to decrease and their oxygen demand to just kind of lower a little bit. So you want to be prepared for all of those situations.
That's a good point. I actually hadn't thought about the oxygen part, but it makes sense. And even I think that sometimes it's comforting for patients too, to feel like they have oxygen being blown into their nose. So just to help them through that kind of moment of terror when they're either shocked or we're restarting them with adenosines.
And it's always best, again, ACLS, you're covered in these protocols, but it's always, always, always best to have a provider there if you can.
Absolutely.
Which is not always the case, but if you can, you know, then it's not all of your responsibility. I love having someone else there that they're like, okay, you're going to do this now. And if anything goes bad, I'm like, well, you told me to do it. It wasn't just my decision.
And you're charting the heck out of that mm-hmm. afterwards. No, absolutely. Absolutely. It's kind of cool to think that, you know, all these procedures that we can do as nurses that can quickly save someone's life or save them from a horrendous complication.
Yeah.
And it's within our scope of practice. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool to be able to realize this. Especially as a rapid response nurse, you're doing these all the time. Anyway, I think it's so cool what we can do with our license and our knowledge.
I mean, there's even times too whenever I go home after a long day of work, if I have a lot of people that were just really hanging in the balance, and my husband will say, "What do you want for dinner?" And I'm like, Joe, I've made life and death decisions all day. Can you please decide if we're going to have a sandwich or spaghetti? Like, my mind, after being on point all day, I just don't want to make the little decisions anymore because it's our job is so important, and knowing what we can really do and how we can prevent people from dying, how we can prevent people from having injuries that's going to be lifelong or for decades later. It's an amazing thing for us to have gone into.
Absolutely. It could be a heavy weight, but the way I describe nursing is you're right in the thick of people's like juiciest moments in their life. You know, ones that they're never going to forget, and we get to be present.
Yeah.
And we get to play a role in that. And it's, for me, it's such an honor.
I agree. I could not agree more.
Yeah. All right. Jamie, thank you so much for joining me today for this episode. And again, thank you all for coming today, whether in person or virtually. I'm really excited to hear the rest of the sessions today. So thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys. Don't forget to claim your free CE unit for this episode. And please share this podcast with your fellow nursing colleagues. If you feel like this podcast is adding a lot of value to you as a nurse, you can help me out by subscribing and leaving me a review on Apple Podcasts. Doing this helps other nurses find this podcast. That's it for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.